Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the very first day of March. Jeremy Scahill is our guest this hour. We have interviewed Jeremy over the years on a number of important issues. He's from the Milwaukee area, and he is a writing fellow for the Nation Institute. He is national security correspondent for the Nation, and he is the author of this week's cover article, Washington's War in Yemen Backfires. He looks at the counterterrorism campaign being conducted in Yemen and says that it could be fostering the very movements and sentiments that it seeks to quell. He has recently returned within the last couple weeks from that country and writes a report about his time there, the intricacies of what's going on with the failing government, the uprisings in various parts of the country, who the U.S. is funding, is Al-Qaeda a presence there, are there other groups that are terrorist groups that have a presence there, why are people aligning themselves with some of these groups, what are the humanitarian services that are being provided to them. Jeremy is also author. He probably came to prominence with his book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. He is an intrepid investigative journalist and correspondent, and we are delighted to have him with us this hour of the program. And I should tell you, hour two, Senator George McGovern will be joining us to talk about his latest book, What It Means to Be a Democrat. Your phone calls are very welcome. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Kathleen. Good to be with you.
I think your next assignment should be to someplace where all is tranquil and you can figure out why.
Yes, I'd like to go down and do an expose on the coastal waters in Barbados.
You deserve it at this point. Believe me, go do it.
Last time you and I talked, I had just gotten back from Somalia.
Yeah.
Actually some of the same issues raised in Yemen, you know, this sort of blowback and what will the impact of our policies, our counterterrorism policies in both of these countries and others be, you know, 4 years down the line, 10 years down the line? I mean, that's really been the focus of a lot of my reporting over the past year, is looking at potential future consequences of actions we're taking now.
Mm-hmm. Why did you choose Yemen?
Well, you know, if you pay close attention to what the senior counterterrorism officials in the White House have been saying pretty much since President Obama took office, what you realize is there's a pattern of them identifying Yemen as the single greatest terrorism threat externally facing the U.S. homeland, whether it's David Petraeus, who's now the director of the CIA, or James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, and President Obama himself. And so I really started focusing on Yemen soon after President Obama became president. It took me 2.5 years to get a visa to Yemen. And it's a very, very difficult country to get into. The dictatorship of Ali Abdullah Saleh, he ruled for 33 years, basically locked the country down to journalists after the December 2009 so-called underwear bomber plot, when this guy Abdulmutallab Abdulfarouk tried to blow up a plane over Detroit. And you know, part of the reason why Yemen took that move is because they were concerned that potential jihadists from the West or from other countries would try to come into Yemen, and so they locked the country down, and it was very difficult for foreigners to get into Yemen, and I sort of fell victim as a journalist to the sort of lockdown state. But I finally got in then. Just one day they called me and they said, oh yeah, your visa application's been approved 2.5 years later. So I went there because I wanted to investigate what the actual threat was from this group that was being mentioned so much by senior officials, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and also to look at the expanding undeclared war zones that we have right now, Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, the Philippines, elsewhere on the African continent, in particularly in North Africa, around the Maghreb, and sort of looking at this new world of asymmetric warfare post Iraq and Afghanistan, and what that sort of indicates about the future of the U.S. war machine.
How did you answer after your time there the question as to whether or not Yemen presents the single greatest terrorism threat?
Well, Well, you know, there most certainly is a terrorist organization called Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and, you know, I interviewed people very close to that group. It's very difficult. It would be very difficult for me to interview the leaders of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The risk of kidnap would be very, very high. And with the U.S. drone strikes, you know, certainly Western journalists are monitored when they go to these countries. And, you know, I could potentially find myself in a situation where a missile is coming down, crashing on the scene of an interview. So the best I could do with interviewing, you know, people around that world are tribal leaders that deal with them all the time. And they said clearly to me, yes, these guys are terrorists. Yes, they would love to destroy America if they could. Do they have the capacity to do it? Probably not. So do they represent an existential threat to the United States? No, not at all. Do they represent a threat of potentially being able to bring down an aircraft or killing U.S. aid workers or blowing up a pipeline that U.S. oil workers are working on? Absolutely. But I think that there, you know, having said that and recognized that there is a threat there, I will say that I think that the U.S. is U.S. policymakers are really exaggerating the nature of the threat, and I think you know, we have to sort of have our policy be more consistent with the reality on the ground. There's about 700 members of this organization, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and you know, I think what is a more disturbing trend is that some of our policies aimed at killing these individuals that are in this organization have actually angered people that had nothing to do with those groups, and in the process are sort of popularizing the ideas of some very radical, unsavory characters. Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the drone strikes that have killed civilians?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. It's a little more nuanced than that. And it's very common in journalism now to make the mistake of thinking that all of the strikes are drones. What actually has happened in Yemen is there certainly are drone strikes, as you mentioned, but some of the worst strikes in terms of their impact on civilians have actually been launched from submarines in the Arabian Sea by the U.S. military, not the CIA, and they've come in the form of Tomahawk cruise missiles and cluster bombs. Which, of course, are basically like flying landmines. And, you know, President Obama first authorized a strike against Yemen in December of 2009, actually on December 17th, 2009. And Tomahawk cruise missiles hit this Bedouin village in a very remote area of Abyan province, which is in the south of Yemen, and ended up killing over 40 people, including 5 pregnant women. And at the time that strike happened, the Yemeni government took responsibility for it and said it was a Yemeni attack. We later learned through the leaked cables from WikiLeaks, and also I went there myself and filmed U.S. missile parts, that they were in fact U.S. missiles. And what it seems, Kathleen, is that the Yemeni government on a number of occasions has fed very bad intelligence to the U.S., told them, here's an Al-Qaeda training camp. The U.S. then authorizes a strike, and it turns out that they've hit a village where, you know, the connection to Al-Qaeda is flimsy at best. In the case of that village, there was only one person that was identified by anyone that I interviewed that was connected to Al-Qaeda, and he was a former Al-Qaeda member who had fought in Afghanistan during the Mujahideen War, when the U.S. was also backing the Mujahideen there. So, you know, I think the U.S. has been played to some extent by the regime of Ali Abdullah Saleh, sometimes to take out his political opponents and to do strikes in areas where his opponents are organizing. Mm-hmm. And other times, I think he has given the U.S. intelligence in an effort to sort of make himself relevant, to say to the U.S., there's these scary terrorists here that want to destroy you, and I'm going to give you information on a training camp. And part of it is he wanted to keep his relevance. He wanted to keep the flow of counterterrorism money open. And his government was just stealing money regularly for 10 years from the U.S. under the guise of fighting terrorism, when in reality a lot of what he did was take some money that we gave him to fight terrorism and build up forces that were intended to defend his regime.
Hmm. When you talk about tribal leaders and the U.S. policy enraging tribal leaders, can you give us a better understanding? We think of Afghanistan when we think of tribal leaders. Is there any parallel? What kind of tribal leadership and tribal setup is there, Jeremy, in Yemen?
Yeah, I mean, the most powerful institutions in Yemen, as in Afghanistan, are these tribes. And in the south, the tribal leaders were largely expelled from the country from 1960 to 1990, when a socialist government was governing South Yemen, and they expelled all of the sultans and the emirates, and they forced them to flee. When Ali Abdullah Saleh unified Yemen in the early 1990s, he cut a deal with all of these tribes to come back into the country, and he gave them control over their areas that they had, you know, been absent from for 30 years. Oil riches were there, natural resources, the heart of agriculture in Yemen is all in the south. And so these tribal figures, in return for supporting the dictatorship of Saleh, were given their land back. And as a result, they became like sultans again. And so any major disputes within Yemen over land, over political differences, over killings that happened, theft from the micro level all the way up to national policy, the most important power brokers in that country are tribal leaders. And some of these tribes have over a million people in them. Ooh. And yet Yemen is a country of 24 million people. So, you know the way that Saleh maintained his power for all these decades was by playing this this game with tribal leaders. When it was to his benefit, he would support them. When it was to his benefit, he would allow Islamic militants to break out of prison and stage some attacks in their areas. And he was a very clever political manipulator. And so these tribes are very powerful. They control the economy of the country. They have at times supported the government. And so when you look at the situation of al-Qaeda in Yemen, you realize that the majority of the al-Qaeda members are also members of very powerful tribes. And if the tribes want them to shut up, be quiet, and sit it out in a field somewhere, they're going to do that. But if the tribes are angry because a missile hit their village or an aid project was canceled or they're running out of water and the Yemeni government's not doing anything about it and the U.S. isn't giving funding for it or the Saudis aren't giving funding for it, they'll say, why should we fight al-Qaeda? We'll let these guys, who are also members of our tribe, well, they'll let them make some press conferences or videotapes, or we know that they're plotting an attack against Yemeni troops, but we're going to look the other way this time because the government isn't answering to our demands. So part of what's happening there is that the tribes are fed up with the corruption of the U.S.-backed government, and they're also really angry about a series of airstrikes that have killed people that were not attached to al-Qaeda. And so it's kind of a tinderbox that is ready to blow in the south of Yemen. And that's what really was the thrust of my piece, was looking at how our policy, which is intended to do a targeted war of attrition, where we're killing individual people in a sort of systematic way, has at times succeeded. And even when they kill the right person, it angers Yemenis because they feel like it's a violation of their sovereignty. But there have also been a number of really awful misfires where civilians have been killed. So, I mean, it's a very complicated, I wouldn't pretend to be able to give you a comprehensive definition of why tribes are so powerful in Yemen, but just to give you a flavor for it, the tribes really are the power brokers and have been for basically all of Yemen's history, with the exception of about 30 years when the socialists were in power. Mm.
And what about those basic services? You mentioned lack of water, water pumps, electricity in the article. Are those substantial problems in Yemen and nobody, or perhaps the, quote, terrorists are helping people out with those? Those are basic concerns.
Right. I mean, Gregory Johnson, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, who is a Yemen scholar at Princeton and has worked for USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, in Yemen, really has said that the problem of terrorism in Yemen and the rise in prominence of these terrorist groups can be directly tied to an utter lack of funding for building up the infrastructure of Yemen. Yemen's going to run out of water, out of drinking water, and it's going to be the first country in the world to completely run out of water.
Really,
it's ironic given that there's a movie coming out about the salmon fisheries of Yemen, which is a sort of Hollywood movie.
Yes.
But the reality is that water is in very scarce supply. Life expectancy is very low. Unemployment is very high. It's the poorest country in the Arab world, and there are a number of extremely poor countries.
Oops, hello? Hello? Well, that line was so clear, and then we just lost him. Jeremy Scahill is our guest, and we'll pause and return to his words about Yemen running out of water, and then we'll welcome phone calls. Are you there, Jeremy? Hello? He's not there. There's something wrong with our line. So we'll finish that sentence and then welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. You can also read Jeremy's piece in The Nation. It's the cover story of this issue, Washington's War in Yemen Backfires. He is the national security correspondent for Nation, and isn't that a story? After it taking 2.5 years to get a visa, they called and said, okay, you have a visa. So off he went to a place where it's pretty dangerous to travel. Phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, Senator George McGovern will be joining us. He has a new book. It is titled What It Means to Be a Democrat. He will join us hour two of the show. Jeremy Scahill is here the first hour. Finish the story if you're with us about they're running out of water, and we'll start taking phone calls, Jeremy.
Right. Yeah, you can hear me now, right?
Yes. I don't know
okay,
what happened.
Good.
Yeah, I can hear you.
No, the point I was making, though, is, you know, Greg Johnson, who's at Princeton University and has worked for USAID, you know, said that there's this direct relationship between the rise in influence of some of these terrorist or militant organizations and the lack of employment, the crisis of water in the country, the fact that you know, young people basically have no prospects for creating a better life, and so. On the one hand, you look at the fact that the U.S. gives a disproportionate amount of military aid when compared with the amount of civilian aid that we give, and that's true of Britain and other major powers. That everyone is sort of monofocused on the terrorism issue, and Yemen's infrastructure is completely non-existent. The other thing I should mention, Kathleen, and this is kind of a wild aspect to Yemeni society, almost the entire country is addicted to chewing this this leaf, this narcotic-like leaf called khat, and literally the entire country shuts down at 2 p.m. every day. And from 2 o'clock to like 10 o'clock, people are chewing this drug and talking. And it's how everything gets resolved in Yemen. And it actually is quite wonderful to watch some of the conflict resolution. And you'll see people that are arch enemies from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. then sit down, break bread, and chew this drug together long into the night. And I full disclosure, I did a lot of chewing khat when I was there because I realized I will get nothing done journalistically unless I start going to khat chew. So I chewed khat with President Saleh's inner circle, and I chewed khat with, you know, street kids in Change Square where the protests are. And I learned a hell of a lot more about Yemen than I would have if I didn't addict myself to this drug for a few weeks.
What a job you have.
Yes, and I didn't enjoy it at all, Kathleen, I assure you.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's an amazing
American
story.
Diplomats, and this is something that rarely gets talked about, American diplomats are banned from chewing khat. Diplomats from other countries are encouraged by their governments to go and, you know, chew khat with Yemenis because it literally is how you find things out. I was denied permission to go to this area of the country that al-Qaeda had taken control of by the government. I went to a khat chew with senior government officials, and at the end of it, they're like, oh, yeah, I guess we can let you go down there. And they wrote me a permission slip to go down and visit this area that no journalist had been allowed to before. And it's because I chewed khat with them for 8 hours, and, you know, they call it building castles in the sky.
What is it, some kind of plant?
It looks kind of like a basil leaf, and it's it has you buy it in stalks that are almost like buying some, you know, a dozen roses, but they have all these little leaves on them, and they're very soft, and you pull them off and you chew them, and you create a sort of Louis Armstrong pouch in the side of your mouth, and it's, you know, it's sort of like it's an upper, but it's a mild upper, and it really kind of opens up, you know, I'm going to sound like I'm an advocate for drug use here.
Yes, you are.
It opens the mind, and I found myself talking a mile a minute and then listening a mile a minute too to stories that probably the next morning weren't as interesting as they sounded at that moment. But that's how you get things done. And I tell that story because it actually is it's a part of, I think one of the great failures of our foreign policy is not recognizing and trying to put ourselves within the cultures of the countries that we're operating in, either as journalists or policymakers, and trying to actually understand where people are coming from. People have a lot more trust in someone that is able to walk in and respect their culture than they would by someone who sneers at them and is like, you're doing drugs?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not really viewed as drugs there by a lot of people. It's viewed as a social enabler that helps to resolve conflicts and move things along. It also results in a bazillion half-done construction projects.
Let's go to phone calls. Justin in Green Bay, hi.
Hey, Kathleen, how are you?
Yeah, speak up, Justin. Can't hear you very well.
Oh, can you hear me now?
A little better.
Okay. Well, Jeremy, I was curious as to know the president that was recently elected with like a 99% majority or whatever in Yemen. What are his relations to Saudi Arabia and Egypt? Because I know that the history involving Egypt and Yemen and more recently Saudi Arabia seems to have hegemony over the entire Arabian Peninsula. I just wanted to, see your opinion on that. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. That's actually a very good question. So just to give people a little bit of context, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had been the dictator of Yemen for 33 years, recently agreed to step down. In fact, he was in New York, where I'm talking to you from, a few weeks ago, supposedly receiving medical treatment. But as much as I could gather, he was living large at the Ritz-Carlton and doing a lot of shopping and going out to eat. But anyway, he left the scene, and they had what they called an election, but it was really just a vote where one candidate was on the ballot, and you could vote yes or no. And he was a former vice president to Ali Abdullah Saleh. And so he now is technically the president of the country. But the reality is that Saleh, the former dictator, quote-unquote, of Yemen, his family is in control of everything still. They control the military, they control the intelligence, they own all of the businesses, the powerful businesses in Yemen, and they still have control over some of the tribal networks that kept them in power. As far as Saudi Arabia and Egypt go, I mean, Saudi Arabia is by far the biggest foreign player inside of Yemen, and they have thousands of people on their payroll as informants. The Saudis regularly come in and bomb the north of Yemen, where there's a Shiite minority called the Houthis, and the Houthis have been in a rebellion against the central government for many years now. And the Saudis have been deeply, much more than the U.S., deeply involved militarily in Yemen. And I think that what's going to happen, not just with Saudi Arabia and Egypt and the relationship between Yemen and those countries, but also with the U.S., is that the status quo is going to be maintained. The U.S. is going to continue to be able to do drone strikes in Yemen, covert operations on the ground. The Saudis will continue to play ball in a very serious way inside of Yemen. Egypt has its own problems right now, and Egypt's foreign policy has taken a very far back seat to the domestic political situation in Egypt, where you have a sort of Mubarak after Mubarak reality, where there's a military dictatorship that is similar to Mubarak's, just without Mubarak in power there. So Egypt has pulled back from some of its international either meddling or involvement a great deal since the revolution in Tahrir Square.
Let's go back to those 700 members, which doesn't seem like a whole lot, but obviously they're problematic for us. 700 members of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Is it important for us to understand what drives those people to join the organization? What is their philosophy? What are their goals? Does it make sense to have a foreign policy that targets them specifically for extinction?
Well, no, I mean, I don't think. In fact, I was just with Dr. Emil Nakhla, who was the former senior CIA analyst who retired a few years ago, and he was the head of the CIA's political Islam division. And he and I were discussing this exact question. And, you know, he was saying that there is no military solution to the fight against al-Qaeda. If you can't fight them on the battlefield of ideas and drain the swamp of their popularity by undermining their vision of the world, then you're only going to encourage the organization to spread because you're fulfilling their prophecies that Yemen is the next Afghanistan, which all these al-Qaeda guys said, you know, the U.S. is trying to turn Yemen into Afghanistan. And so by killing leaders, I mean, bin Laden was one thing, and I'm sure you've done shows on it. We could talk for hours and hours about what the death of bin Laden meant. But on a local level in Yemen or Somalia or North Africa, where there are regional nodes or regional organizations that are affiliated with al-Qaeda, they've taken on lives of their own, and they've achieved a sort of level of relevance within their own countries based on the corruption and excesses of the regimes in those countries. So al-Qaeda in Yemen recently has started to rebrand itself as something called Ansar al-Sharia, or the supporters of Sharia law, and have sort of tried to campaign on a platform of peace and stability. And they've implemented very harsh Sharia law systems in a number of cities in the south of Yemen, and they've provided basic services. They're providing school. They've restored electricity in some cases. They're paving roads, and they've created courts where people can resolve their differences. They also chop off hands, do beheadings, They're scary medieval people. However, when you live in a lawless country, and I saw this in Iraq as well, you know, there's a reason why Iraqis say, "Oh, it was better under Saddam." It's not that they love Saddam. Saddam was a heinous murderer, but at least you could walk down the street without getting blown up as long as you didn't believe in having freedom of speech. So in Yemen, it's sort of similar, and I think that the real battle is going to be over hearts and minds and who's able to better provide. And right now, in some areas, the Al-Qaeda-linked groups are providing where there's a total vacuum. They are jihadists. They do have a vision of establishing a caliphate. They are motivated by a sort of Salafist, Wahhabist view of the world, and they're anti-modernists, and they're ruthless individuals. And I think that there is a threat there, a potential threat there, but it's so minuscule. When you look at the rhetoric from the U.S., it's overkill. There's a way to address these Islamist militant movements that doesn't necessitate drone bombs and missile strikes, and it has to do with supporting the very indigenous forces that can push back against them. In Yemen, it's tribes. The tribes are not. There is not a militant Islamist tradition that has dominated Yemen's history. These are a minority of people, and they could be put in check. But instead of working with the people that could do that, we're angering them. And that's sort of the call I was making in my article, was for U.S. policymakers to rethink this and to stop, in an almost paranoid way, hyper-focusing on missile strikes and to look at the bigger picture. Because the bigger picture is that there's a lot of potential allies in Yemen who want nothing to do with terrorism emanating from their borders.
And when you talk about supporting them, what kind of support?
Yeah, I'm not talking about arming tribes and creating a version of the Contras on the Arabian Peninsula.
Right.
I'm saying to encourage business development within Yemen that hires local people to do water purification projects, to in a positive way exploit the resources for domestic benefit inside of Yemen. To support the agricultural industry, to support educational programs. I think it's far more important for the U.S. to give non-military aid to Yemen and to ensure it's being used outside of the confines of the corrupt networks of the Saleh family than it is to focus on $1.4 million cruise missiles that at times hit villages full of innocent people. So I think it's, there is a Western educated population within Yemen that I think would be very, very natural allies for the U.S. and other countries to sit down with and say, how can we support development in your communities?
Laura in New Berlin, hi.
Hi, Kathleen and Jeremy. Say, I really appreciate hearing about the cat stories. It sounds wonderful. But on the downside, I have an understanding that the water crisis is exacerbated because huge portions of water go toward the growth of this plant. So what is the thinking about how this country is going to deal with increasing water scarcity?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's very impressive that you bring that up, because it's a huge part of the water crisis is that, this country of 24 million people is almost entirely addicted to this drug, and they use their existing water supply to grow cot crops. So it's a self-defeating addiction in the country, but it's a reality. In fact, there was a huge rally planned against cot chewing when I was there. And when I went there, everyone at the anti-cot rally showed up to chew cot and watch
what
would happen.
No.
So there were like a couple hundred people rallying against cot, and everyone else was chewing it while watching them. Sort of an entertainment for that day. But it is, it's a very, very serious crisis. And the United Nations has issued multiple alerts about this. The U.S. is certainly aware of it. But the best that they've come up with right now is desalinization, taking the salt out of salt water. And it's, that's not the healthiest water. It's not sustainable. And Yemen's in serious trouble. And that's part of what I'm saying, is that we're spending all this money on military stuff to deal with 700 people that, at best, pose a threat to, some airplanes once every 10 years. They need to be addressed. But we're disproportionately spending money on that threat when there's a much realer threat of the country imploding and Al-Qaeda's vision taking root because they were there to catch people when they were falling. And that's my biggest concern in both Yemen and Somalia.
So is there anybody in Washington who's trying to figure out a policy that will keep people from falling?
You know who actually was a very sort of visionary guy on this stuff and understood both Yemen and Somalia, pretty well was former Senator Russ Feingold. When he was on the Foreign Relations Committee and the Intelligence Committee, he was one of the few people in Washington that actually seemed to get what the potential threats coming out of Yemen and Somalia were. And while Senator Feingold did speak within the parameters of Washington speak for on counterterrorism policy about those countries, he also had a far deeper understanding of the relationship between poverty and terrorism. And I think there's a huge hole in Washington now that was left by the departure of Feingold on some of these very serious foreign policy issues. I think it's a club of cluelessness when it comes to what's happening on the Arabian Peninsula and in parts of East Africa in Washington. And it's frightening how little attention is paid to these issues at the expense of focusing on, whoever's able to put a nasty video on YouTube first from these countries. I mean, it's really kind of sad that there are not more prominent voices in Washington addressing the root causes of terrorism, not just in those countries, but around the world, in Afghanistan also.
It's sort of hard to believe, isn't it? Because there are certainly Yemeni scholars. You've mentioned them. Somebody would sit down and take you out to lunch because you were just there and you're a great journalist. Why is it so hard to find out what actually is happening and to believe one truth rather than trying to dig out the complexity of the story?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is this gets into sort of technical speak, but I think part of it is that there's a really high turnover of U.S. diplomats in these countries, whereas other nations will have someone posted in Yemen for 10, 15 years, really, get to know people, cultivate sources, and get a granular understanding of what's happening there. So part of it is just the technical issue of diplomats not wanting to be posted in Yemen, doing short terms there, and then rotating out of the country. I also think that it's part of the trend in Washington where a lot of the resources go to counterterrorism operations and very limited resources go to USAID or other non-military entities of the U.S. government. There are very brilliant people that came out of the CIA, that came out of academia, that came through the State Department that do have an understanding of it. And I've talked to several of them, particularly from the CIA, that say no one would listen to us. We would talk about these things, for decades in meetings, and all people cared about was where are the terrorists? Where are the people that bombed the USS Cole in 2000, which was this horrifying incident where a U.S. ship was blown up off the coast of Yemen? It's part of this obsessive tendency regarding terrorism that we've had in this country since 9/11, where everything else becomes a secondary issue. And what we're missing is the relationship between poverty, the relationship between corrupt regimes, and the rise of these militant or terrorist groups is the core issue. And it's the one we pay the least amount of attention to, unfortunately.
More phone calls for Jeremy in a moment. Our number, thanks, Laura, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Jeremy Scahill is from Milwaukee, actually, and he's done some top-notch reporting from some very frightening parts of the world. Somalia is the last time, he just returned from Somalia the last time we spoke with him, and now he, after waiting for a visa for 2.5 years, just returned from Yemen, and he writes this week's cover article, Washington's War in Yemen Backfires. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, or you can send an email if you'd like to do that. That is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, Senator George McGovern will be joining us. He has a new book, What It Means to Be a Democrat. His parents were Republicans, but he switched allegiance due to FDR. He writes about how important he was and his projects were to helping McGovern shape his views about what it means to be a Democrat and what the role of the government should be. The book looks at all of the issues that are very important to him. He, of course, was for 10 years until the last soldier left in 1975. The war in Vietnam was at the top of his mind, and so we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the WIC program. We'll talk about the fact that Republicans and Democrats don't talk to each other anymore. We'll look at drug programs. We'll, of course, talk about the economy and jobs and many other issues with Senator George McGovern, hour two. All right, more phone calls for Jeremy. Let's go to Linda in Egg Harbor. Hi, Linda.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You know, listening to Jeremy speak about the disconnect between understanding the link between terrorism and poverty in Yemen reminds me of what's been going on in the United States for decades, where, you know, the relationship between, let's say, gang violence and poverty and ghetto lifestyles and things along those lines. So it seems to me that what's needed is an increase in overall consciousness on a global scale at home as well as overseas. And, you know, it's not just country specific. It seems to me that we need to address the mentality of how we approach these things overall. And if we're not doing it at home, I can't see us doing it anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, I have nothing to add to that. I think it's a good point.
Thank you, Linda, very much for your call. Mike in Iowa, hi.
Yeah, I guess my question is, it's kind of like what the lady before said, but why do we have to be involved in all this around the world? Why can't we take care of the poverty and the stuff within our borders? Why is it we have to be the world police and get ourselves involved and spread ourselves so thin around the world? Why can't we just have nice, good border security and just take care of our own? I don't understand why we have to be around the world taking care of everybody.
I mean, that essentially is, you know, what the Republican candidate for president, Ron Paul, has been saying in these debates. And you know, and I do think that there is a growing trend toward isolationism within the United States, and I think it permeates both you know, traditionally conservative communities and more liberal communities, and it coming at it from very different ways. But I do think that one of the results of the wars of the past 10 years, both declared and undeclared, and the economic crisis in the U.S. Has been that people are starting to rethink some of these foreign engagements, entanglements, and wars. I do think, though, not to push back against it, but to sort of just put another, you know, sort of ingredient in the mix here, where I do have some sympathies for, you know, a U.S. government perspective on these things is that there is a direct relationship between potential threats to the United States and poverty, corruption, in a lot of these countries. So I do think we have to have some limited form of engagement with the rest of the world, and there are actual national security threats that have to be addressed around the world. What I would say, though, is that almost all of the military actions we've taken over the past 10 years have contributed to destabilizing our security rather than increasing our security. And I think not just because war is expensive, but also on a moral and security level, it's cost us almost an incalculable amount of money and clout in the world, our policies over the past 10 years, and have helped to sort of semi-bankrupt the country. And it's very seldom that any public officials talk about the relationship between the spending on all these foreign adventures and wars and the economic situation in the United States, the relationship between powerful corporations in the U.S. and the war machine, and who has the actual, who benefits from these policies. So I think a lot of Americans would be sympathetic to what the caller says because they're hurting. I mean, Wisconsin knows it, you know, better than any other state right now in this country. When you see the stripping of workers' rights and the war against teachers and, you know, the war against the middle class and poor people in this country, you know, Wisconsin has been a laboratory for a lot of this stuff, and it's and that's part of why it's blowing up. So we're here talking about Yemen, but people in Wisconsin are feeling a pinch too and saying, why are we spending money on all of this stuff when we're struggling, when our schools are falling apart? Why are we spending money on foreign, you know, wars and entanglements? Why should we have anything to do with Yemen when our inner cities are imploding every day?
Thanks, Mike, very much for the call. Carl in Madison, hi.
Yes, hello. I think the guest's just most recent comments are in line with some of my own thinking. As I've been listening, the unbelievably fantastic ineptitude of our foreign policy in case after case, whether it's burning Korans in Afghanistan or what the guest is saying about our policy in Yemen. It's either fantastic ineptitude or there are people who are benefiting that make the missiles and make the bombs, that if we don't have people angry at us and carrying on terrorist activities against us, we don't have any missiles and bombs to explode and thus replace. And I'm just curious the guest's perspective on the financial gain and the political interaction between the people who make our armaments and decide our foreign policy, given our abysmal track record and either complete blindness to seeing where we're headed being completely ineffectual or a design that looks like blindness but is actually calculated. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, well, I mean, I this may not be the sexiest answer to that question, but I actually think the answer to your question goes to our campaign finance system in this country. You know, a lot of members of Congress end up in Washington because of contributions from corporations that stand to benefit from war. And the way it works on a sort of micro level is that Lockheed Martin develops some truly awesome new kind of drone that can be equipped with a, you know, a missile that can that's the size of a butterfly, but can blow up an entire village of Al Qaeda terrorists, and then they're walking in the halls at Langley with their badges on that allow corporations to walk around the CIA, and they're allowed to look at classified intel, and they go and they say, oh, you're going to be doing this operation against Al Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Well, we've got this drone with a missile the size of a butterfly that can do X, Y, and Z, and then the mission planner says, oh, well, actually for this mission, let's try to use this thing that the Lockheed guys have, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling thing where you have the toys, and they're amazing. Toys, and everyone in the war industry and the counterterrorism community is talking about it, and they're just looking for a target. So our foreign policy is almost a bunch of hammers flying around the world looking for nails, and that's what it's come down to. So I think part of it is that politicians vote for these policies in part because of who's putting them in Washington. I think a big part of it is ineptitude and lack of focus on the core important issues, you know, in favor of focusing on, you know, killing bad guys, which is all anyone wants to talk about in Washington when it comes to terrorism. How many of the bad guys did we kill? And part of it is that it's big money, and it's big money for the war industry, and they're creating all these cool toys that they want to unleash on the world, and that's a big part of the drone warfare thing. Because we have the toys, we've got to use them.
Let's focus on what we could have done in Yemen for just a moment, because when you think about the number of countries in the world where there are bad problems, where there is poverty, where our relationship has been less than savory with these countries, it's kind of overwhelming. If you look at the Saleh regime, the U.S. relationship with Yemen over the past, I don't know how many, 20 years, go wherever you want to with that. Are you calling for a substantial change in the way that we deal with these countries? What would that be so that we wouldn't run the risk of being scared to death that some terrorist from one of these countries is going to enter the United States and do us great damage? Because after all, that's what's driving all of this.
I think we need to demilitarize our counterterrorism strategy. I mean, I understand why there are very strong advocates, you know, certainly among the Democratic Party and among the Obama administration, for wanting to target and kill the leadership of an organization that says its main goal is to destroy the United States of America and to attack U.S. civilians and to bring down aircraft and all these things. I mean, I understand why, you know, we're a nation that has become afraid of Al Qaeda and Islamist militants, and so I understand why those in power think that's a good idea. But I what I'm calling for is to demilitarize our counterterrorism approach, because we actually are creating more of a threat, even in killing some of these people, than we would be by leaving them alone and beefing up our intelligence spending, our non-militarized intelligence spending. Having good relationships with sources within these countries is worth infinitely more than killing a mid-level commander of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And at the end of the day, if we don't take away the motivation of people to join these groups and instead conduct operations that increase the motivation to join those groups, then we're creating a problem out of our strategy for trying to defeat that very problem. And that to me is just, it's so counterintuitive, and it invites the kind of blowback that we saw in 9/11. And so, you know, I think we should immediately stop bombing Yemen. I think it has no gain for us whatsoever. And I think we need to seriously rethink our strategy in Pakistan as well, in all of these countries. I think it's enough is enough, and I think we are. It's diminishing returns now, and it's going to backfire.
Ellen in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I'm really. The only two things I can say is why don't we see this? Several people that were big presidents in our country warned us. One of them said there's nothing to fear but fear itself, and another one said beware of the military-industrial complex. Aren't we forgetting those things? And isn't a better way to help, you know, to go in and help poor people?
Jeremy.
Yeah, I mean that's part of what, you know, she's saying is what I've been talking about. You know, of course you're referring to Eisenhower talking about the military-industrial complex. I mean, I think on a domestic level in this country, the way that our elections are financed has a huge impact on our foreign policy. I mean, in fact, you know, the Citizens United ruling and this huge, you know, the corporations are people now. All of this is related to foreign policy, and it's funny to me how few people in the foreign policy world seem to get that connection. Like, there's a direct relationship between how people end up in Washington and the policies they advocate. And so, I mean, that to me should be one of the premier issues for the younger generation of people that were politicized by the 2008 election, is to become involved with looking at how money affects politics and how that affects our foreign and domestic policies. It's the premier issue on a political level, I think, for young people. And I would just encourage young people to really get deep into reading about how campaigns are financed, because it has everything to do with the foreign and domestic policies implemented by this government.
Diane in Michigan writes, Jeremy, who, if anyone in Washington, have you directly shared your insights with?
Well, I mean, I've actually been invited on several occasions to testify in front of Congress. In fact, the last time I was there, I was testifying about these targeted killing programs, and it was in front of the Judiciary Committee. And Jim Sensenbrenner, who, of course, is a Republican from Wisconsin, walked out of the hearing right at the beginning of it and said he didn't want to talk about it. And he left the room, and the Republicans then boycotted the hearings completely. But Sensenbrenner led them in marching out of the room before. And it was a panel of people, some of whom were pro-war, and some of whom were being critical of these policies. But Sensenbrenner said, we don't want to talk about this anymore, and got up and left the room. You know, and unfortunately, the number of Democrats that want to talk about these issues is very, very small. People that during the Bush era would welcome me into their offices to sit down to brief them on Blackwater, they want nothing to do with criticizing President Obama's policies or even exploring a different way of looking at it. It's like they've consolidated ranks, and we're in election season, and, you know, this stuff doesn't sell. Nobody cares about it in an election year, and I think that's a sad part of how U.S. politics are run. So my phone is not ringing off the hook to come to Washington to brief anyone on Yemen.
Greg in Glidden, hi. Greg, are you there?
Good morning.
Hi.
Yes. Doesn't that set a poor standard when with Yemen? We should be taking care of our own problems in this country.
Yeah, that's what the other caller said, too, and that's a lot of what we've been...
I agree with that Mike from Iowa. I agree with that gentleman wholeheartedly. We have no business being over in Yemen. Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is something we're hearing a lot, and as much as I think the, you know, the Tea Party is just a caravan of crazy, I do think that part of what has motivated some people within the Tea Party to become political is that the economy is in utter shambles. People are suffering, and people turn to kind of extremist views, and they double down on the hatred in their heart. And I think there's a lot of bigotry and racism attached to what's happening within that movement. But I also think there's something that's legitimate among a lot of people, you know, that motivated them to get involved with it, and that's that their lives suck right now. They don't have a job. They can't put their kids through college. You know, if you're Rick Santorum, it's a snobby thing to want to put your kid through college. But the point is, everyone, a lot of people are suffering in this country because of the economic situation. And it's similar to what's happening in Yemen. When you're suffering, you turn towards some form of extremism. And I think the Tea Party is very similar in that way to people moving towards some of the extremist movements in other countries, because you want someone to blame, and you want your life to make sense, and you want it to be someone's fault. And I think that's part of what we've seen over the past 3 years in this country with the rise of the Tea Party, is that a lot of people were hit really hard, and they turn to hatred, but they also turn to extremism because they are suffering tremendously.
Thank you, Jeremy, so much for being with us. I enjoyed the article, and it's always great to hear from you and to know that you're back safely.
It's my pleasure. And next time I'm in Milwaukee, Kathleen, I'll come into the studio and hang out.
Hey, will you?
Yeah, it'd be fun. My pleasure.
Yeah, great. We'd love to have you here any old time.
All right. Thanks, Kathleen.
Thank you, Jeremy. Jeremy Scahill, he's from Milwaukee, actually, and we've been following his career for quite a few years now. The article is in The Nation. We'll put it on our Facebook page. We can do that, right, Rhonda? We'll put the article on our Facebook page. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. And I want to remind you, too, that Nancy Pearl's book recommendations are up on that page now, too. It's a real lengthy list. So if you're looking for a book recommendation, you don't need to go any farther than the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, and you will find the recommendations. Jeremy's article is in the current issue of The Nation magazine. He is national security correspondent for that magazine now, and a fearless and very bright investigative reporter. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour.